The ear of the tired listener resting for a moment on our title, The Camel's Back, will presume it to be merely metaphorical. Stories about the cup and the lip and the bad penny and the new broom rarely have anything to do with cups or lips or pennies or brooms. This story is the exception. It has to do with a material, visible, and large as life camel's back. Starting from the neck, we shall work toward the tail. I want you to meet Mr. Perry Parkhurst. 28, lawyer, native of St. Paul. Perry has nice teeth, a Harvard diploma, parts his hair in the middle. You've met him before in Cleveland, Portland, Toledo, Indianapolis, and so forth. Baker Brothers New York pause on their semi-annual trip through the West to clothe him. Montmorency & Company dispatch a representative post-haste every 3 months to see that he has the correct number of little punctures on his shoes. He is a domestic roadster now, will have a French roadster if he lives long enough, and doubtless a Chinese tank if it comes into fashion. Now, I want you to meet his love. Her name is Betty Medill, and she would take well in the movies. Her father gives her $300 a month to dress on, and she has tawny eyes and hair and feather fans of five colors. Now, during the Christmas holidays of 1919, there took place in St. Paul, counting only the people with italicized the, 41 dinner parties, 16 dances, 6 luncheons, 12 teas, 4 steak dinners, 2 weddings, and 13 bridge parties. It was the cumulative effect of all this that moved Perry Parkhurst on the 29th day of December to a decision. This Medill girl would marry him, and she wouldn't marry him. She was having such a good time that she hated to take such a definitive step. Meanwhile, their secret engagement had got so long that it seemed as if any day it might break off of its own weight. Perry decided to Superman her, to get a marriage license and go up to the Medill house and tell her she'd have to marry him at once or call it out forever. So he presented himself, his heart, his license, and his ultimatum, and within 5 minutes they were in the midst of a violent quarrel, a burst of sporadic open fighting such as occurs near the end of all long wars and engagements. It brought about one of those ghastly lapses in which two people who are in love pull up sharp, look at each other coolly, and think it's all been a mistake. In the past, they'd kissed each other wholesomely and assured the other person it had all been their fault.
Say it was all my fault! Say it was! I want to hear you say it!
But this time, while reconciliation was trembling in the air, while each was in a measure stalling it off so that they might the more voluptuously and sentimentally enjoy it when it came, they were permanently interrupted by a 20-minute phone call for Betty from a garrulous aunt. Perry waited.
Betty, darling, how are you?
Auntie, what a pleasant surprise.
I'm not interrupting your preparations for this evening's soiree,
am I? And he waited.
No, not interrupting anything at all.
Oh, good. Little Millicent Tate is already a debutante. Can you believe it?
And waited.
No.
I think she'll be your biggest competition in the coming years.
Really?
And waited.
Because I've heard some saying that they think Marion Cloud has surpassed you in beauty.
Marion Cloud? How? Who says that?
At the end of 18 minutes, Perry Parkhurst, urged on by pride and suspicion and injured dignity, picked up his light brown soft hat and stalked out the door.
It's all over. It's all over. If I have to choke you for an hour, damn you.
The lass spoke into the car, which had been standing some time and was quite cold. He drove downtown. That is, he got into a snow rut that led him downtown. He slouched down very low in his seat, much too dispirited to care where he went.
Hey, Perry!
Perry pulled the car over to the front of the Clarendon Hotel, where he's being hailed from the sidewalk by a bad man named Bailey, who had big teeth and lived at the hotel and had never been in love. And it is here, with the course of Perry's life hanging precariously in the balance, that we pick up our story.
Perry, I've got 6 quarts of the doggone still champagne you ever tasted. A third of it's yours, Perry, if you'll come upstairs and help Martin Macy and me drink it.
Bailey, I'll drink your champagne. I'll drink every drop of it. I don't care if it kills me.
Shut up, you nut. They don't put wood alcohol in champagne. This is the stuff that proves the world is more than 6,000 years old. It's so ancient that the cork is petrified. You have to pull it with a stone drill.
Take me upstairs. If that cork sees my heart, it'll fall out from pure mortification.
In the room upstairs was a pink man reading a pink paper devoted to ladies in pink tights.
When you have to go into the highways and byways...
Hello, Martin Macy. Where's this Stone Age champagne?
What's the rush? This isn't an operation, understand? This is a party.
Perry sat down dully and looked disapprovingly at all the neckties. Macy leisurely opened the door of a wardrobe and brought out 6 handsome bottles.
Give me champagne.
Going to the Townsend Circus Ball tonight?
I'm not.
Invited?
Mm-hmm. Why not go?
Oh, I'm sick of parties. I'm sick of them. I've been to so many that I'm sick of them.
Maybe you're going to the Howard Tate's party.
No, I tell you, I'm sick of them.
Well, the Tate's just for college kids anyways.
I tell you.
I thought you'd be going to one of them anyways. I see by the papers you haven't missed a one this Christmas.
I'll never go to any more parties. That side of my life is closed. closed.
Now, when a man says close, close like that.
You can be pretty sure that some woman has double-closed him, so to speak.
Trouble with Betty, old boy?
No. Give me that bottle. Yes. She's positively irrational. We've been engaged for months, and she claims my proposing her tonight was too sudden. She says she's too young. Betty, she thinks marriage will ruin her. Can you imagine the audacity of marriage to a man of my prospects ruining her? Betty, I knew it from the start. I knew. I just didn't want to see. She's too conceited for love. She should marry a mirror. Betty.
After an hour of this, the clock chiming six moved Bailey to action.
Betty Medill. Who needs her?
Perry, old boy, you're not fooling anyone. Macy, our boy needs some cheering up. Let me have a crack at that piano of yours, will you?
Crack away.
No, let it alone, Bailey.
No, I've had enough of your operatic a cappella piney. Betty, this party needs a new kind of song.
Oh, no, don't subject me to more torture. I was just starting to feel better.
Sorry, you had your act. Now it's my turn.
Macy, we can't let him get away with this.
This sounds perfect. I can do it. I can do this. You just gotta believe.
I believe. Yes, I must be leaving.
I see the problem. Mm-hmm. Here we go. The night was mighty dark, so you can hardly see. The moon refused to shine. Perry and Betty sat beneath the willow tree. For love, they did part. Betty Mae was kind of frightened, so she said to Perry, I guess I'll go. Perry began to sigh, looked up at the sky, told the moon his little tale of woe. Help me, Macy. Shine on harvest moon up in the sky. Since January, February, June or July, snowtime ain't no time to stay outdoors and swoon. So shine on, harvest moon for Perry and his gal.
You guys are killing it.
What are you killing? Yeah. That's a beautiful song. Okay, you can do better.
No, just stop.
Do whatever you think you can do better. Go ahead.
Boy was walking underneath the willow tree with the one he loved so true. All he had to say is, won't you be my bride, for I love you. And I could wear a happy face. Sadly, this is not the case. When our engagement suits her well, mention marriage and she'll storm and yell.
Shine on harvest moon up in the sky.
How you getting it, Perry?
I had no love since January, February, June, or July. Snow time ain't no time to stay outdoors and spoon. So shine on harvest moon.
The trouble is,
said Perry, who had just banged his hair with Bailey's comb and was tying an orange tie around it to get the effect of Julius Caesar.
You fellas can't sing worth a damn. As soon as I leave the air and start singing tenor, you start singing tenor too.
A natural tenor voice lacks cultivation, that's all. I've got a natural voice, my aunt used. It's natural, good
singers,
tenor.
Singers, you're all good singers. Huh? Albert, no, not cabaret. I want some doggone clerk. It's got food. Food, you know? Like something to eat. You know,
Julius Caesar, man of iron will and stern determination.
Hey, would you shut up a minute? I'm on the phone. Say, is Mr. Bailey, just send up an enormous supper. Use your own judgment right away.
He connected the receiver with some difficulty, and with an expression of solemn intensity, he went to the lower drawer of the dresser and pulled it open. In his hands, he held a truncated garment of pink gingham. This was a pink blouse, a red tie, and a Buster Brown collar. Look it. Costume for Townsend Circus Ball. I'm little boy carries water for the elephants. Perry was impressed in spite of himself.
I'm going to be Julius Caesar.
I thought you weren't going.
Me? Sure I'm going. Never miss a party. Good for the nerves, like celery.
Caesar? You can't be Caesar. He's not a circus. Caesar's Shakespeare. Go as a clown.
No, Caesar.
Caesar?
Sure, chariot.
Ah. That's right. Good idea.
You lend me a bathrobe and this tie.
No good.
Sure, that's all I need. Caesar was a savage. They can't kick if I come as Caesar if he was a savage.
No, get a costume over at the Costumers, over at Nolak's.
Perry decided he would, but first he ate a great amount of filet mignon and drank his third of the last bottle of champagne. At 8:15, Macy walked him out to start his roadster.
Froze up. Cold, frozen, cold air.
Can't start it?
No, let it stand here till summer. One of those hot old August days will thaw it out all right.
Gonna let it stand?
Sure, let it stand. Take a hot thief to steal it. Give me a taxi.
Macy summoned a taxi.
Cab driver, take me to Nolak's, the costume fella.
And so off they went. Mrs. Nolak was short and ineffectual looking, and on the cessation of the World War had belonged for a while to one of those new nationalities. Owing to unsettled European conditions, she had never since been quite sure what she was. The shop in which she and her husband performed their daily stint was dim and ghostly. In a vague background, many rows of masks glared eyelessly at the visitor. When Perry ambled into the shop, Mrs. Nolak was folding up the last troubles of a strenuous day, so she thought.
Something for you?
I want a costume of Julius or the charioteer.
I'm sorry, but every stitch of charioteer is rented long ago. You wanted it for the Townsend Circus Bowl?
Yes.
Sorry, but I don't think there's anything left that's really circus.
This is an obstacle. Say, if you've got a piece of canvas I could go as a tent.
Sorry, but we haven't anything like that. The hardware store is where you have to go. We have some very nice Confederate soldiers.
No soldiers. Want something distinctive.
Let's see. Well, we have lion's head, a goose, and a camel.
Camel?
This idea seized Perry's imagination, gripped it fiercely.
Yes, but it needs two people.
Camel. That's the idea. Let me see it.
The camel was produced from its resting place on a top shelf. At first glance, he appeared to consist entirely of a very gaunt, cadaverous head and a sizable hump. But on being spread out, was found to possess a dark brown, unwholesome-looking body made of thick, cottony cloth.
You see, it takes two people. If you have a friend, you could be part of it. Well, you see, there's sort of pants for two people. The fella in the front does the looking out through these here eyes, and the fella in the back, well, you just gotta stoop over and follow the fella in the front around.
Put it on.
Obediently, Mrs. Nolak put her tabby cat face inside the camel's head and turned it from side to side ferociously. Perry was fascinated.
What noise does a camel make?
What?
Asked Mrs. Nolak as her face emerged somewhat smudgy.
What noise? He sort of brays.
Let me see it in a mirror.
Before a wide mirror, Perry tried on the head and turned from side to side appraisingly. In the dim light, the effect was distinctly pleasing. He was majestic. He would have attracted attention in any gathering.
You see, you have to have two people.
Perry tentatively gathered up the body and legs and wrapped them about him, tying the hind legs as a girdle round his waist. The effect on the whole was bad. It was even irreverent, like one of those medieval pictures of a monk changed into a beast by the ministrations of Satan. At the very best, the ensemble resembled a humpback cow sitting on her haunches among blankets.
It don't look like anything at all.
No, you see, you have to have two people.
A solution flashed upon Perry.
You got a date tonight?
What? I couldn't possibly.
Oh, come on, sure you can. Here, be a good sport and climb into these hind legs.
With difficulty, he located them and extended their yawning depths ingratiatingly. But Mrs. Nolak seemed loath. She backed perversely away.
Oh, no.
Come on, you can be the front if you want to, or we'll flip a coin. Make it worth your while.
Now you just stop. None of the gentlemen ever acted up this way before.
Perry sat down on a three-legged stool to think it over. He named over to himself those friends on whom he might call, and then his mind paused as Betty Medill's name hazily and sorrowfully occurred to him. He had a sentimental thought. He would ask her. Their love affair was over, but she could not refuse this last request. Surely it was not too much to ask to help him keep up his end of a social obligation for one short night. And if she insisted, she could be the front part of the camel and he would go as the back. His magnanimity pleased him. His mind even turned to rosy-colored dreams of a tender reconciliation inside the camel, there, hidden away from all the world.
Now, you'd better decide right off.
The bourgeois voice of Mrs. Dolek broke in upon his mellow fancies and roused him to action. He went to the phone and called up the Medill house.
Good evening, Miss Medill. Is Betty in? Oh.
Miss Betty was out, had gone out to dinner. Then, when all seemed lost, the camel's back wandered curiously into the store. And that concludes Act 1 of our play. We'll be back with Act 2 right after your next course. But before we leave you, please listen to these brief messages from our kind sponsors.